first segment of Admissions Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to that sublime moment when you can jump up and down and holler, "Yes, I'm in." Now, I'm fairly active on Twitter and hang out there probably a little bit too much. And over time, I had seen some valuable and insightful tweets from a certain smiling avatar there. Curious, I decided to follow my mouse and clicked my way to the medical school headquarters and a highly informative site with a valuable podcast for pre-meds and med students about to start the residency application process in particular. After listening to a few of the podcasts and subscribing so that I can easily get future shows, I decided to invite Dr. Ryan Gray, the founder of Medical School Headquarters and the host of that podcast, to Admissions Straight Talk, because pre-meds, the pre-meds among you, would really benefit from meeting him and acquainting yourselves both with his work. And before I start my conversation with Dr. Gray, I also want to remind you of a relatively new feature here. We invite your questions. If you have an admissions-related question, just go to the show notes at info.accepted.com/67, and you will see a widget that will allow you to leave an audio message in which you can ask your question. You can speak using your computer mic or your phone. You can also send me questions via email at questions@accepted.com. If your question is chosen, I'll ask and answer it on the show. And now back to our guest, and I'll provide a little bare bones background about Dr. Gray, because we're going to be learning more about him from him. He graduated from the University of Florida with a BS in exercise and sport science. He earned his MD from New York Medical College in 2009 and is currently a flight surgeon with the U.S. Air Force. Dr. Gray, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Linda, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Okay, great. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey to becoming a flight surgeon in the United States Air Force, becoming a physician and then the flight surgeon?
Well, as you stated, my journey started at the University of Florida. And even before then, during high school, is when I kind of realized that medicine was what I wanted to do, dissecting a cat my senior year of high school. I had that weird kind of thought that says, I want to cut things for a living.
It wasn't the frog that did it in 10th grade bio?
No frogs, just
no
cats.
Frogs? Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So it was the cat, Mr. Bigglesworth was his name, and the rest is history. From there on out, I was dead set on going to medical school to become an orthopedic surgeon. I had played baseball my whole life and wanted to kind of marry those two passions, and what better way than orthopedic surgery?
Sure.
And so I went to University of Florida and started my pre-med journey and continued on, went to medical school, and am doing what I'm doing. We can go a lot deeper as much as you want.
Okay. Well, one thing I have to ask you is, what is a flight surgeon?
The ever question, what is a flight surgeon? So
yeah, do you do surgery in the air, or is it
the image that pokes into people's minds, that pops into people's minds, is surgery on an airplane? that is furthest from the truth.
Okay.
So a flight surgeon is a misnomer. It goes back to the old days when every physician in the military was called a surgeon. For some reason, flight surgeon has stuck. What I am is I am a general practitioner. I'm basically a family practice doctor for pilots, their families, air traffic controllers, other people that work on planes and do other stuff. It's a very unique job. It's more of an occupational health job than anything else, because pilots have a very unique working environment, and so I need to make sure they're safe in that environment. So that's what I do.
And
so I work in a clinic on the ground.
Okay. Did you pursue orthopedic surgery as you intended initially, or is it something that you still want to do?
It was something that I pursued. I signed up for the Air Force HPSP scholarship, and with that commitment comes the need to apply to the Air Force residency match and get accepted to be an orthopedic surgeon prior to finishing the applications for the normal match. And so when I applied through the Air Force said, no, we don't need you as an orthopedic surgeon, but go do a one-year transitional or one-year internal medicine internship, and you can reapply. And so I did that, did a transitional internship up here in Boston, and reapplied for orthopedic surgery. And again, they said, nope, we still don't need you as an orthopedic surgeon. You're going to go be a flight surgeon. And I, at that point, I was like, what the heck's a flight surgeon?
I'm not the only one.
You are not the only one. And it's actually a kind of a mission I'm on with my podcast as well, is kind of getting the word out of what flight surgery is. And it's really not flight surgery what we practice. It's aerospace medicine, which is a whole different name and confusing. But it's a great job. You build great relationships with patients. You get to go fly. You get to it's a very cool job. And so I am a staunch evangelist now for flight medicine and aerospace medicine.
And what is aerospace medicine?
Exactly what I do. Exactly okay. What I told you I've done. Yeah.
All right. So are you, let's say, determining how long people can stay in space or in flight, or are you basically making sure that pilots are safe? Because it's not just their safety that's at stake. If a pilot is not healthy enough to fly, obviously the people on the ground or the passengers.
Yeah, correct. No, the example I always give is if a pilot comes to me with knee pain, versus you going to your doctor for knee pain, your doctor's going to say, you're fine, here's some physical therapy, go back, you can do your job.
Right.
My job, if a pilot comes to me with knee pain, I have to understand what his job is. So I have to understand what type of plane he flies, how much effort he has to exert if maybe one of the engines goes out and he needs to push with full force on one of the rudder pedals to keep the plane straight while it's flying.
Uh-huh.
And I have to integrate all of that information, which is why it's required that I go and fly with these guys a minimum number of hours every month.
I see.
And so I can understand that environment and go, you know what? You can't go fly, so I'm going to ground you for a couple weeks, let your knee heal, and then when it feels better, come back and see me, and I'll return you.
Okay. All right. Well, that definitely gives me a clearer idea. That's wonderful. Now, how did you and your wife, Allison, come to found medical school headquarters, and what is it? In your words, not mine.
the medical school headquarters was started after realizing that a lot of people were coming to me while I was active duty. Well, I'm still active duty. But when I first started active duty, I had a bunch of people just step into my office and say, hey, Dr. Gray, what do I need to do to get into medical school? And I would sit with them for an hour, hour and a half, and just pour my guts out. And I remembered back when I was a pre-med student and my advisor telling me that I shouldn't apply to medical school because I was a white male.
Oh,
there's no chance you're going to get into med school. You're a white male. I had a good GPA. I don't think I'd taken the MCAT at that point, but it was just absurd. And so I obviously ignored her and relied on a good collaborative environment of friends that I had. We were all pre-med. And that's really my message, is collaboration and hard work. You can get into medical school as long as you do decent enough. You don't have to be perfect, but you have to be good enough.
Right.
And so that's why we started the medical school headquarters. Obviously, everybody knows Student Doctor Network is out there. And for the majority of people going to that site, they walk away intimidated, or click away intimidated, as it is. And they go on there and they think that they have to have a 4.0 GPA. They think they have to have a 40 MCAT to get into medical school. If they don't have that, then they have to go to the Caribbean or do something else. And my goal was always, if I could get one person to leave Student Doctor Network, come and find my site, and let them realize that they can get into medical school and watch them on that journey into medical school and practicing medicine, then I've done my job.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we started the medical school headquarters.
Okay, great. Now, we're going to get back to the whole point about a collaborative community in a minute, but what is the Medical School Academy? And is that an outgrowth of the headquarters, which came first, or did you intend to have both all along?
No, the original goal, actually, for the medical school headquarters was to develop a bunch of information and just kind of leave it there. I wasn't planning on making it this big project that it's turned into. It's almost it really is a second job for myself and my wife.
Yeah, clearly.
It was meant to put up a lot of data-driven information, a lot of information from the AAMC. They put that information out there so that people can get real answers. And what ended up happening was we were enjoying the communication with the students that were emailing us and letting us know that they enjoyed what we were putting out there. And what ended up happening was we started the website in March of 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And after some back and forth and starting and stopping, we launched our podcast, the Medical School HQ podcast, at the end of November of 2012. So do the math there. Mm-hmm. 9 months later or so.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been 88 weeks now straight. We release a podcast every week on different topics, mostly related to the pre-med path. And the academy started because we realized that we were just getting so many questions, a lot of the same questions, and it was more of a one-on-one interaction. And I realized that people like communities. Obviously, Student Doctor Network is popular. It's a community. People like interacting with others. And so Allison and I sat down and talked about how we could create a community that provided value to all these pre-med students with questions on their path. My original goal was to create a barrier, basically. I wanted a community of non-anonymous students.
Right.
The Student Doctor Network is totally anonymous. So you could go in there, be some 50-year-old Billy Bob hobo, as I always call him, and go and shoot down everybody because his son didn't get into medical school.
Right.
You know, you don't know who's in there answering stuff.
That's right.
So I wanted a non-anonymous collaborative environment. So the Academy is exactly that. It's a membership site, so it's not free, which I think raises the bar. So people that really want that collaborative environment are willing to pay a little bit of money for it. And it's not a lot of money.
No.
And so they join. We have a non-anonymous community. As I said, we do question and answer office hours every month. This past month, we've done three mock interviews with different students that are applying this year. We're excited that a couple of our students are starting medical school this year. So it's been a great journey, and we have almost 80 students in there collaborating, and we have some other physicians in there helping out. And one of the biggest things that people love are our specialty series. So we interview other physicians and talk about their specialties and what life is like and what their journey was like. And I think a lot of students really like that part.
That's great. And when I was, again, looking around on your site, I was really struck by, especially on the Academy, on the focus on a collaborative community and the fact that you were insisting on real names and non-anonymity, identity, really. And I think that's fantastic. I don't know if you remember this. This was probably in the late 90s, mid-late 90s. This is very early in the popularization of the Internet. There was a medical school site, and I think it was called Chronometer, something like that. It was C-H-R-O-N-O something. Mm-hmm. And the guy running it was a fairly young physician. I don't think he was a resident anymore. He could have been. He could have been a resident. And he was responding to questions on this very basic bulletin board, like I said, mid-late 90s bulletin board. But it was anonymous. And he finally shut it down because he was just so ticked off, really, about the low level of the conversation and the nastiness and all that. And he shut the whole thing down.
Yeah. It's very easy to hide behind a fake username and say things that you normally wouldn't say in a open, honest relationship.
Right.
And with medicine nowadays, and we preach this all the time as practicing physicians, the collaboration with all of the other staff and other physicians and nurses and social workers is you need to be able to collaborate with other people. And if you can't, you will not survive. And it's a necessity, and it needs to start early on. And one of the biggest issues that I think pre-meds think is that peer sitting next to them in their physics class is their competition.
That's right.
But if you actually break down the data, and I'm sure you've done this, the actual statistics aren't as bad as they look. There are a lot of people applying to medical school that probably shouldn't at that moment in time.
Right.
And so they bring down the numbers a lot.
Right. The other thing is, if you can collaborate with your competition, you are going to basically, or at least some of your competition, you will improve your chances of acceptance as well as that of specific individuals. You're not improving the world. It's not necessarily going to be at your expense.
There's a reason the saying is two heads are better than one.
Right. We had a situation. This was actually in the MBA side of our business, where a certain school was having team and group interviews. So we set up mock interviews. And then after the mock interview with us, which was paid for, we encouraged them to practice additionally on their own. And the first thing out of one of the students, applicants' mouths was, well, then aren't I helping my competition? You know, this was... And we said, look, if you work with each other, you and the person you're partnering with are improving your chances of acceptance. And if you happen to find yourself in the same team interview, you can play off each other. Mm-hmm. Now, in most cases, there were several different, groups. There were small groups, like 4, 5, 6 people. So obviously the chances were pretty slim. But it did happen. And those two individuals were able, because they had collaborated further, in the whole point of these team and group interviews is to show how you work with other people, that you can collaborate.
Exactly.
So they were so much ahead of the game. And, and this has happened several times. It's not just one time, but it was almost like, well, aren't I helping my competition? So, well, why don't you worry about helping yourself before worrying about helping your competition, and then you can both do better. Yeah. And each case it was the same concern, and then we'd ask, look, we're not going to give out any names and email addresses unless you give us permission. They would almost all come around and then, be very grateful that they had done so. So... I couldn't agree with you more about the damage anonymity can cause to human behavior. It's sad but true. And then the other thing, though, I mean, you focus very much. I'm kind of coming at from it from an admissions perspective that, and a rather selfish perspective that collaboration will actually help you get in. And don't worry so much about helping somebody else if it's going to help you. But I think you're coming from the value of collaboration in a much broader sense.
I am coming from the collaboration in all senses. So,
okay.
Yes, collaboration through your pre-med journey, understanding, and I truly believe that you can't go through the pre-med journey alone or else you'll be miserable, because you have to understand that there's somebody else miserable right next to you. it is a brutal journey, but one worth taking, and that's I stand behind that fully. But yes, in the broader scheme of things, I think collaboration for a working physician only does better for the patient. And that's our ultimate goal, is taking care of patients.
Right. Okay. So we've learned a little bit about you and your journey, and obviously about medical school headquarters, and we are going to link to it in our show notes. But let's turn to a few of the issues faced by pre-med and med students. Now, one issue I think that's coming up more and more at this time of year is just, how do you advise medical students who want to submit their primary application in August or September, the MCAS app. Do you advise them to wait until next year or to give it a go? Or perhaps a better question might be, whom would you advise to proceed and whom would you advise to wait?
So I think the ultimate answer is don't wait until August to apply.
Of course. That's the assumption.
Goal, yes. And my biggest goal in life is to let students know that they need to be applying early. The medical school admission process is a game of musical chairs, and the longer you go, the less chairs there are.
Right.
But,
great metaphor. Great metaphor for it.
It is. You can use it if you want.
I will.
So I come from two sides. You have a 0% chance of getting into medical school if you don't apply.
Correct.
So your chances are a little bit better than that applying in August or September. So
that's comforting.
If you want that chance, and I wish the data was available, but they don't release that information of who applies later and what those statistics are because I'm a little jaded in this, but the AAMC and medical schools are out there to make money. And if students knew that the later you applied, the less likely you are to get in, that's money that is being left off the table.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are competitive applicants, probably more than the average, because if you're applying later, you're competing against more people for less spots. So you need to stand out. Then apply. What's the worst that's going to happen? They're going to say no. But then you go down a path of what do you do in your gap year, because you're going to have take a year off, and how are you going to show when you apply again what you did differently or what you added to your resume that makes you stand out even more? Because that's what schools are going to look for. They're going to see that you applied and didn't get in, and then they're going to want to know what changed over that year.
Well, hopefully you applied June 1, but that's not what you're talking about, I realize.
No, yeah, and there was a I think it was a NIH professor was giving a talk to pre-med students, and he said if you're applying after, like, July, in July or later, he's like, you're already showing you've already failed your first medical school test. You're showing medical schools that you can't prepare, you can't organize, and you can't prioritize.
Right.
And I wholeheartedly agree. But I think there's just so much out there that students don't understand. They go, they just think, because this is how life has been for them, they think that they're going to take the MCAT and then applications are going to open and then they're going to fill out all their information and get the letters that they need and get all the transcripts and everything will be hunky-dory. And they'll write their personal statement in a weekend. But
right.
There's just so much more planning and preparation that goes into it. Stuff that you need to start thinking about your freshman year. And that's what I wish more people understood, is that this whole process takes your whole undergrad career.
Yeah, and I know I don't entirely understand it. I know we've worked with many people that come to us. I mean, we work with some people who are really on the ball. I mean, they will come to us in April or May, and they submit the first week of June, and they're, you know, turning around those secondaries and cranking them out, and obviously very motivated, very organized, and they tend to do very well in the application process. But there are others, and they might be, you know, usually just fine people also. There's nothing wrong with them. And they'll come, yes, I want to be, I know it's important to apply early. And maybe even they start getting secondaries. Maybe they apply at the end of June. Well, the end of June isn't horrible.
No.
And then they start getting secondaries, but they don't get them turned around.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking with somebody I know socially, and I said, look, it's really important that, you know, your son turns them around. And she said, yeah, I know, but I can't do anything. And he knows. And I know that some of them know. People, you know, again, peers will come to me. My son's applying to medical school, and I want to help him. And, you know, he's going to work with you. I say, okay, great. And I said, but, you know, he has to get started. And so the applicant has the parents' support. Parents are behind them. And they offering them assistance. And they just, it's like, you know, it just doesn't, I don't know why. I don't fully understand it. I wonder if there's some ambivalence about the whole process. But whatever. I agree with you.
Well, I can think back to my process. And yeah. I had to apply twice. The first time I applied, I didn't get in. And so I took some time. I fixed my application. I was missing a big important piece called shadowing. Mm-hmm. And I reapplied. And I remember getting secondaries and sitting on them.
Yeah.
And not wanting to fill them out because in my mind, I was over the hurdle. I had spent all this time and energy on the primary application, and I was just burnt out. And I think that's the biggest part of it is everybody is just so burnt out that they don't have the energy to continue going, and the ones that do better. And it's just a realization that when you click submit on your primary applications, that's not the finish line.
It's a starting gun.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, let's move on. Different questions. Now, for those people who did get their primary applications in a timely fashion and are now turning out secondaries, what are your key pieces of advice for pre-meds? And what is a key difference between the primary application and the secondaries?
I think the secondaries allow students and medicals, it allows the medical schools to see what makes you more different.
Mm-hmm.
I think the primary application is very standardized. They're looking at grades and MCAT scores and demographics and your extracurricular activities. And for the most part, a lot of that stuff is going to be very similar student to student. There are only so many extracurricular activities that you can do. Or I interviewed a student a couple weeks ago on my podcast who started a volunteer organization that is now doing 15 hours a day of volunteer work at the cardiac care unit for children at Shands mm-hmm. Hospital in Gainesville.
Uh-huh.
And so that extracurricular activity stands out because she started this whole thing from scratch. But the majority of students aren't doing that. And so the secondary application typically gives you the opportunity to write another essay. Yay. It gives you another angle, typically, to tell the admissions committee something about yourself. And it's an important thing that you need to do.
Right. I also think that the secondary, depending obviously on the questions that are posed, are really much more about fit between the applicant and the specific school that sent out the secondary.
Correct. And a lot of students don't realize that an admissions committee is trying to put together a community of that class.
Yeah.
So they don't want all 4.0 students. They don't want the all type A personalities. They want people from every walk of life that has experienced many different things, because those 100 people, 200 people are going to be a very tight-knit community for several years. And so that's what they are trying to do, and those secondary application questions help them create that community.
I think you're right. That's why the individuality that you referenced is so important. But as much as they want to create that diverse class, they also want a diverse class of people who are going to be very happy at that particular medical school.
Yep.
So now I listened to an outstanding interview that you did with Dr. Norma Wagoner on your podcast. I think it was MSHQ19.
Yep.
And I know you've spoken to many, many experts in medical school admissions, and obviously you yourself went through the process. What are your top tips for the traditional med school interview, as well as for the MMIs, the multiple mini interviews?
So I just have to say that I love that interview. Dr. Wagoner was amazing.
That was fantastic. I'm going to link to that also in the show notes. It was just a fantastic interview.
So just to preface that interview, she is a PhD in anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
She's been the dean of admissions at three different medical schools, at Rush, at Chicago Pritzker, and at University of Colorado. So she knows her stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And we talked all about the application, or not the application process, the interview process.
I think you talked all about the application process, but there was a lot on the interview there.
Yeah. That's what I tried to cover a lot on that one, was the interview. And so I think I forgot what your question was because I was excited to talk about her.
What I wanted was your tips on the interviews, both the traditional medical school interview as well as the MMIs, which you did cover thoroughly in that particular podcast.
So it comes down to preparation.
Okay.
You can't show up to an interview cold. Number one, you have to know the school that you're applying to. And obviously you applied to it for a reason. So you have to understand in your head and be able to articulate why you want to go to that school. Because there's a good chance that they're going to ask you, why do you want to come here?
Mm-hmm.
And you can't say, I like the weather. Because that's not going to fly.
You
really have to do your homework and understand why you spent $36 applying for the AMCAS application to that school, plus the travel there and hotel and everything else.
And why you'd consider spending close to $200,000 to attend.
4 years and several hundred thousand dollars to attend, exactly. And so I think that's step number one. Even before that interview starts, before the acceptance for the interview starts, is when you are selecting those schools, is making sure in your mind that you really want to go to these schools. But I think one of the biggest keys in preparing for a medical school interview is the mock interview. Interviewing is a skill that can be learned, that most people are terrible at to begin with.
Right.
And so you need to go to your pre-health office, most pre-health offices or career counseling services at your school will typically have mock interview sessions that you can go and practice. And everybody has a camera in their pocket these days, a video camera with smartphones, and record yourself and watch it and critique it and have somebody else critique it and learn what your nervous habits are. If you say a lot, or if you blink weirdly or smack your lips or do some, whatever it is, understand that all of that plays into the perception of you when you're going for your interview. And so definitely do mock interviews as many as you can. You talked about that earlier with the MBA folks.
Mm-hmm.
Do your homework, know your application inside and out. Know your research that you've done, because they're going to ask you about it. And if you don't know what the research was about or what the results were, then that looks bad. And go with some good questions to ask the people that are interviewing you, to ask the students, to get a better idea of what the school is like. And understand that it may be your number one school before you go, and it may drop down to your last place school, because until you actually set foot on campus, you don't know what that environment is like and what that vibe is like.
Right, for sure.
So the MMI, I think, it's the same. You prepare. I don't think you just need to understand that you need to be able to communicate well, so the mock interviews will help with that as well. The MMI is a newer, more popular thing. I think it's better for the applicant because it'll remove a one-person bias from the application process.
Right.
But it's probably stressful because you're turning around, going into a room, and you don't really know what's behind the door. So, but I think if you are yourself and you don't stress and you breathe, you'll be fine.
Okay. Now, let's turn for a second to the residency match process, which is gearing up or going to start soon. What are the key differences between the med school application process and the residency application process?
So the biggest key difference is you're already in.
Right.
You don't have that looming over your head of, am I going to be a doctor or am I not? So that lowers the barrier a little bit and lowers the stress level. But then you get into, what do you want to do? Not everybody at the end knows what they want to do. There are plenty of people that apply to multiple specialties when they're applying to residencies.
Right.
But the biggest difference, I think, is you're applying for a spot that's typically one of a few or several seats. Residency programs are typically pretty small. You can get big internal medicine classes and stuff like that, but for the most part, it's a very small group of people. And when you are applying, it's more of a job application. They're interviewing you to see how you would fit with them. And so it's a little bit more laid back. A lot of the time there's a dinner involved because they want to hang out with you and see if they can work with you for the next 3 to 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a sales pitch. They're giving you a sales pitch to come work at their hospital, and you're trying to figure out if you like it there and you like those people. So it's a really big difference. The vibe is just totally different.
It's more of a job interview.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that we see very, very typically is in the residency personal statement, as we see this as a mistake. Medical school students sometimes try and just recycle their personal statement, their MCAS essay.
Yeah, and that doesn't work.
That doesn't work. It's a big mistake. You don't need to explain why you want to be a doctor. You might need to explain why you'd make a great orthopedic surgeon or neurologist or gynecologist or whatever the specialty might, gastroenterologist, whatever the specialty might be. And I think that the point you're making is a very good one about it being more of a job interview. And like you say, some of the stress is off. But I think one of the key differences is that, well, you don't have to justify becoming a doctor anymore, but you do have to say why you'd be great in the particular specialties that you're applying to.
Yeah, you have to understand that for the most part, once you pick a residency, you're kind of stuck there. Obviously, people switch and you can. It's not the easiest thing in the world, but you need to sell to these residency programs why you're going to be a good fit in that residency program and why you're going to be an ambassador for that residency program as a specialist in whatever you're doing or a generalist, and let the world show what type of orthopedic surgeon hospital X residency program puts out. And so you need to sell to them in your personal statement why you're going to be an amazing orthopedic surgeon and why you want to strive to be an excellent orthopedic surgeon and what you hope to do with your life as an orthopedic surgeon, not just as a doctor anymore.
Do you have any tips for people about to enter the match process in terms of ranking the programs? I think this always causes a lot of stress and consternation.
A lot of stress.
Yeah.
Apply broadly. I think everybody freaks out with the lack of residency spots that we have.
Yeah.
And there were 500-something U.S. graduates that didn't get a residency spot last year.
Right.
Again, I would love to see who those people were and if they were applying to super competitive residencies. And they didn't apply broadly enough because they thought maybe they were competitive enough for a residency position where they weren't competitive enough. And what was their application like? So that you can't always look at the general numbers of 500 people didn't get a residency spot and go, oh, Lord, we're in a crisis here. So I think you have to understand your application. And do you truly fit to go to Harvard residencies, or should you go to, I don't want to call out any school, but I'll call out my school. If you want to go to University of Florida, so two great hospitals, but one is Harvard.
Right.
And so you have to understand your limits. You have to apply broadly and target those residency programs where you want to be.
What suggestions do you have if somebody doesn't match? Scramble.
Breathe, yeah. The whole soap now that they have.
Right. So.
And it's probably very deflating to an ego. To know that nobody wanted me, I think is probably the thought that enters most people's minds. But it's not the end of the road. There is the soap that you can go and get a last-minute spot. it might not be exactly what you want. You might have to take a year detour and do just an internal medicine or transitional medicine or even a general surgery one-year internship before figuring out and reapplying. It's not the end of the road. It's just a speed bump.
That's a good way to look at it. Do you know how many soap positions there are? In other words, I don't either. So, all right. Well, Dr. Gray, I really enjoyed our chat. It's been wonderful really talking to you, getting to know your story a little bit. Where can a listener learn more about Medical School Headquarters?
So our website is medicalschoolhq.net. They can go and find our podcast there. I'm very active on Twitter. I'm at medicalschoolhq.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody can email me, ryan@medicalschoolhq.net.
Sounds good. We'll include a link in the show notes at info.exhibit.com/67 to Medical School HQ, to Medical School HQ on Twitter, and also to that outstanding interview that you and I were talking about with Dr. Wagoner. Listener, I want to thank you, too, for joining Dr. Gray and me for our 67th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, please share the good word by leaving a review on iTunes. Your doing so will help us spread the word about Admission Straight Talk, because iTunes will rank AST more prominently if it has more reviews, especially if it has 5-star reviews. So if you think it deserves those 5 stars, please let iTunes know. And there's a link in the show notes to our iTunes page where you can leave a review, info.accepted.com/67. And if you have a question for me, please ask it again at that URL I just gave, by sending an email to questions@accepted.com. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.